Just as in Chinese, the same ideogram is used for both crisis and opportunity, in American Sign Language, the sign for charlatan is composed of two symbols made up of Daniel and Natal. I recently got my hands on a copy of a book called Unbalanced by Stephen Roach. It basically covers the dysfunctional codependent relationship between the US and China. According to the author, America after World War II set itself up as the consumption capital of the world. China decided to re-engineer itself as the production capital of the world, so one economic engine would feed the other. But a funny thing happened on the way to this perpetual motion machine. America's wealth started to diminish. This makes sense when you realize that after World War II, America was the only industrialized nation that wasn't blown up. Because of this extremely anomalous situation, America was positioned to be the industrial titan of the world. At one point, according to South Korean economist Ha Jun Chang in his book Bad Samaritans, 85% of the world's exports were manufactured by the United States. To put this in context for anyone who thinks that China is dominant, China makes up about 15% of the world's goods. America was a powerhouse. The problem? The blown-up countries of Europe would eventually recover. Japan would rise as an industrial power. Little by little, America lost market share. In short, it started to get poorer. Its politicians and bankers wanted to keep post-World War II profits going. Their solution to diminishing productivity? Shaving wages for workers and transferring the proceeds to shareholders. An early gambit was encouraging women to enter the labor force. Labor, like any other commodity, is subject to the laws of supply and demand. The more common a thing is, the less valuable it is. So double the labor pool, and you have more people competing for fewer jobs, which depresses wages for workers. Filmmaker Aaron Russo was told by Nick Rockefeller that getting women into the workforce was one of the stated goals of oligarch-funded second-wave feminism.
He was at the house one night, and We were talking, and he started laughing. He said, "Aaron, what do you think women's liberation was about?" And I said, I had pretty conventional thinking about it at that point. I said, "I think it's about women having the right to work, getting equal pay with men, just like they won the right to vote, you know?" And he started to laugh. He said, "You're an idiot." And I said, "Why am I an idiot?" He said, "Let me tell you what that was about. We, the Rockefellers, funded that. We funded women's lib, you know? And we're the ones who got all over the newspapers and television, the Rockefeller Foundation." He says, "And you want to know why?" He says, "There were two primary reasons. And they were, one reason was we couldn't tax half the population before women's lib. And the second reason was now we get the kids in school at an early age. We can indoctrinate the kids how to think. It breaks up the family. The kids start looking at the state as the family, as the school, as the officials, as their family, not as the parents teaching them." And so those are the two primary reasons for women's lib, which I thought up to that point was a noble thing. You know, when I saw their intentions behind it, where they were coming from when they created it, the thought of it, I saw the evil behind what I thought was a noble venture.
After the profits started to run out from that economic heroin injection, the oligarchs decided to goose the system by engaging in a permutation of the same scheme, firing American workers and outsourcing factories to China. By this method, they could replace American workers who made $35 an hour with Chinese sweatshop laborers who netted about a dollar an hour. The profit differential would once again be funneled to the shareholder class. After this well started to run dry, the business community, in coordination with the Federal Reserve, began promoting illegal immigration in America to depress wages yet more. The problem with all this? If the global system relied on America being the big consumer market of the world, how could Americans buy things if they had greatly diminished wages? Answer: credit. The Fed loosened lending limits and credit cards were flooded across the country to make up the difference in wages. That's why in the past, credit cards were a symbol of prestige, but now they give credit cards to every college student and homeless person. Look at a movie the aforementioned Aaron Russo produced called Trading Places. In this 1980s movie, the main character flashes credit cards to show how wealthy and powerful he is.
"So let me get this straight. I'm going to give you 20 for the cab, and you're going to give me 50 when we get to your house?"
"That is correct. My butler, Coleman, will give you $50, drive you anywhere in the city you wish to go."
"You don't exactly look like the type that has a butler. You know, if you're hustling me..."
"Hustling you? Hustling you? You don't think they give these to just anyone, do you?"
Today, according to Stephen Roach, thanks to easy credit, household sector indebtedness surged to a record 132% of disposable personal income, well above the 43% average over the 1970 to 2000 period. That is to say, they spend 100% of their wages plus 32% in credit card debt to purchase the goods and services they desire. The dark secret of all this is that the credit markets, after the 2008 financial collapse, began to unravel. According to former BlackRock portfolio manager Edward Dowd, the whole COVID infrastructure that was instituted had less to do with a virus than with the collapse of the credit markets around the world.
Well, it's, you know, a lot of people are thinking, did they do it on purpose or is it going to happen anyways? I'm of the opinion it was going to happen anyways, primarily because credit creation needs constant credit creation. And, you know, we've tapped out all the borrowers in the world. You know, after the dot-com bubble, we started exporting U.S. dollars. That's how we created the credit and everybody borrowed in dollars. And then we had the great financial crisis where the bank fraud happened, and then roll forward. All that fraud went under the central bank's balance sheets. It didn't disappear. They bought all those bad bonds. And then government spent like crazy to kind of keep the appearances up for the last 12 years. So we've had zombie economies, a lot of borrowing and spending in via the government side of things. But there's been a lot of corruption and a lot of just the wealthier getting wealthier and the rest of the folks just kind of treading in place. There was a little renaissance in the US, at least when Trump was elected, because their jobs did pick up and there seemed to be some sort of activity again. But he's gone, and Biden is literally either incompetent or doing this on purpose. All the policies he's undertaken have done nothing but to cause inflation. And I could tell you that we're at the end of the rope for the Federal Reserve System. So it's complicated, but I'll try to simplify it.
Sure.
The bottom line is, before the rate hike cycle began, we have indicators. A friend of mine followed these indicators, and I won't bore you to death with them, but they showed that the rate hike cycle was over before it began, meaning the Fed didn't really have any room to raise interest rates because the market was already smelling a coming collapse in credit.
The big theme of Stephen Roach's book, Unbalanced, is that China, since Deng Xiaoping opened up his country's economy, has been predicated on a need to produce goods that Americans buy. The standing assumption is that people in the United States would keep buying things and that China would keep producing them. But what happens when the credit cards run out? What happens when America's real economy is revealed? According to a Zero Hedge article entitled Pulling Back the Curtain on the Real U.S. Economy, we read, "When easy credit and stimulus move out of play, the real economy is revealed. And in our case, the true face is an ugly one." As Adam Smith said in The Wealth of Nations 250 years ago, money is not wealth. Money is just a unit of exchange to get wealth. Wealth, he said, is arable land. Wealth is water. Wealth is shoes. Real wealth is based on productivity. For the last 50 years, America had switched out real wealth for fake wealth. They gutted their industrial capacity and started printing up fiat currency, a policy a little like trying to solve global hunger by Xeroxing pictures of a steak dinner. As the global supply chain starts to buckle and as rising energy costs cripple international trade, Americans just may wake up soon to discover the wisdom of Thomas Jefferson's words. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around the banks will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. The John Birch Society provides a national program designed to counter the big government agenda and to restore our rights. Standing for constitutional freedoms for more than 60 years, the John Birch Society has been a force that protects and restores American liberty and independence. Check them out on jbs.org.